Chapter 18. Weapons Redux. Deciding on the Kernford move, making the move, writing what he could remember about military principles, and attending the conclave were more than enough for Joseph. All of these activities had to compete for his time with prodding his shops and workers for ideas and products to help against the Narthani. He had started working on some of the newer ideas even before Moreland City, and now they'd been moved to Kernford. With Petter Kenrick helping with organization and supplies, Joseph revived several projects, including earlier ideas he had shelved for lack of workers or space or technical issues he hadn't had time to address. The next month consisted of a seemingly endless succession of meetings. Preparations involving the entire clan, meetings with Joseph's workers moving to Kernford from Abersford, meetings to orient new workers, meetings to start new projects, meetings to revise dormant projects, and, to his disgust, meetings with Mara and Dennis to schedule meetings. To Joseph's thinking, too many meetings were of the keeping in touch variety, maintaining contact with individuals and groups. Those meetings he endured, chafing to move on to what he considered productive topics, particularly weapons development and logistical issues. Napalm. Joseph gathered several workers from the Kernford Petroleum Distilling Plant, still under construction, and the soap makers from the Kernford franchise already operating at the new industrial park. He stood beside a chalkboard covering the front wall of his temporary park office. Dennis and Ball was hung out near the back wall, along with two men from the gunpowder plant. "I have a new project that requires you to work together. While I will leave it up to the foreman to choose the team to carry out this project, let me emphasize that it is not a side project, but something that needs to be accomplished as quickly as possible. If more workers are needed or more resources, see me and we'll discuss how to proceed. This is to make a weapon to use against the Narthani. It's called napalm, and you can think of it as a version of pouring burning oil on enemy troops. Most of you are familiar with stories of using hot oil to pour on an enemy trying to break into fortresses, and in some cases setting the oil on fire." Joseph paused and looked around at his audience. Several men nodded, others shook their heads. "If you haven't heard of it, take my word, it's an effective way to discourage attackers. Napalm is a version of that tactic. You'll get written notes about what I'll describe, and those of you who can write have quill and paper to take your own notes. Napalm is composed of different components, such as oils, acids, and kerosene. You'll need to experiment with various ingredients. The objective is to produce a semi-solid, viscous material that can be ignited. In the simplest use, a container of napalm could rest on the ground or be thrown at the enemy by catapult. The container would also be designed with a small explosive device that will detonate at the right time. The detonation will ignite the napalm and spread it over a wide area. You can imagine the effect of such a container exploding in or over an Narthani infantry block. Another ingredient to research is something that can be added to the mixture to make it sticky, so that when it lands on clothing or skin, it is difficult or even impossible to brush off or remove." Joseph paused for a moment. "Let's be clear. The objective is to burn the enemy so badly that they die or are incapacitated." Several of the men looked disturbed. One man from the soap factory blurted,
"This sounds like an abomination, deliberately burning people. I don't believe the word would approve of this."
"It is a terrible weapon," Joseph agreed. "You and all the people are fighting for more than just your lives. You are fighting for the very existence of the Cadellium people."
"I'm willing to fight and die if necessary to protect my family and clan," another man spoke up. But this sounds like something the evil one would think of. What do the Theophists think?
Yusuf sighed.
I have discussed this with the Abbot Walcott of St. Tomo's and Abbot Bainham of St. Sidran's. They hate the very idea, as do I. But they reluctantly recognize the necessity of using every weapon at our disposal against the Narthani.
Dennis surprised Yosef when his voice rose over the general buzz.
Many of our men will see this as a dishonorable way to fight, even if it is against the Narthani.
I can understand that feeling, said Yosef. However, if we do not defeat the Narthani, you and any sons who fought them will likely be dead. Your other sons will be castrated and sent to Narthon as slaves, and your women raped, killed, and many sent to Narthani brothels. What is the price of your honor? If you had to choose, which would it be? Freedom from the Narthani, or your feelings of honor?
Several of the men who had previously seemed hesitant appeared to reluctantly see Yosef's points. The first man who had spoken simply stood and walked out.
And you, Balwas, how do you feel about this weapon? Asked Yosef.
Personally, I hope every Narthani burns in hell for eternity. And if I can help them on their way, then I have no problem.
Most of the other men vocally agreed. Thus ended the discussion on the ethics of burning the Narthani. Dennis, however, had another question.
Yosef, is this really more efficient than gunpowder? If the fuse system can be improved, we could throw containers of gunpowder to explode among the Narthani. We did something like this with the crossbow grenades at Moreland City. Why bother with this napalm?
Good question, Dennis. I see four major advantages of the napalm. One is that the effect lasts longer than gunpowder, which explodes and is finished. Napalm burns for many seconds, up to perhaps a minute, especially the larger glops. Second is that napalm can set other things on fire, grass, shrubs, and wagons, for example. We could also lay petrol or another oil on the battlefield and let the napalm ignite it. Third is that when napalm hits a man, he is at least initially still alive, and will forget everything else in trying to put out the fire. Enemy formations will disintegrate with such men running or rolling around. Even the men not touched by the napalm will try to stay away from those hit, or will try to help put out the fires, either way, further breaking up the formation. And finally, the psychological effect of the napalm. Humans have an instinctive dread of burning, and the napalm will affect the morale of the enemy. Anything to increase the Narthani soldiers' fear and erode the certainty of their invincibility will help us.
Dennis stroked his beard and nodded through Yosef's points. Satisfied that he now had both their attention and their commitment, Yosef continued with what little he knew about napalm.
One formula I remember used one or two parts each of plant oil, naphthenic acid, and oleic acid.
Those of you working with petroleum distillation are familiar with naphthenic acid. Other possible substitutes are olive oil, any other oil, or palmitic acids. When they're mixed, you get a powder. This is then mixed with kerosene to form a slush. Yosef went on to describe the components and where local sources might be found.
Depending on the form of the weapon, the final napalm might need to be thicker. This is something you'll have to work out. Try to find something to make it thicker and stickier, while still allowing ignition, which you will also have to work out. For example, we might want to use napalm containers placed on the ground to be exploded and ignited on command as Narthani troops come near. We will also need an ignition system for when we catapult containers at the Narthani to either go off on contact or after a specified time. The last possibility might be the most difficult.
But you can imagine the effect of a large container of napalm showering flames on an Athani infantry or cavalry charge. Yosef called to the front a portly middle-aged man who had been sitting on one side of the room. Raywin will be in charge of the project. He has shown an admirably devious mind in coming up with novel solutions to technical problems and has worked on improving our petrol distillation equipment and procedures. He will coordinate and, I'm sure, come up with some good ideas. But this will require a group effort with all your skills and experiences. To give you some added incentives to work hard, you should assume that if napalm is going to be useful against an Arthani, you need to have it ready in no more than 3 months. Yosef ignored the groans, the objections, and the rolling of eyes. You men were chosen both for your known abilities and your readiness to try new approaches. Where I came from, it was commonly said that men, such as yourselves, will always say the task assigned is impossible in the time allowed, only to get it done in half the time. This brought some grins and a few laughs. However, we'll be satisfied if you succeed within 3 months. Foundry. The new foundry in Kernford was under construction before Yosef moved from Abersford. Progress accelerated with the decision to move and ratcheted up several more notches after the conclave. Most encouraging was progress with casting cannon barrels. Razil Gurbuz, an Arthani artilleryman, had been taken prisoner at the Battle of Moreland City. Although a career soldier, he descended from a relatively recently conquered people, and he claimed no loyalty to the Narthan Empire. Whatever his allegiance, he freely shared his knowledge of cannon casting. While Yosef had attended the conclave in Ouro City, Maris sent the cryptic semaphore message that Yonful Nifork, foreman of the Abersford Foundry, had reported successful casting of a 6-pounder barrel. Before the conclave, Yosef had hoped the latest trip to Abersford would be the last one for a while, but he needed to see the successful cannon for himself. To his consternation, 2 6-days passed since the conclave before Yosef could free 2 days to get to Abersford to see the new cannon. When the time window finally appeared, Yosef, Balwis, Carnegie, and Dennis were off to Abersford in a carriage. Even Balwis deigned to forego traveling by horse, though his reason was that his horse needed a rest, and he hadn't found a suitable second mount. They arrived in Abersford an hour before sunset. Yonful had been alerted to their arrival and had arranged the demonstration a mile north of Abersford at an open field backed by a 40-foot rock outcropping, their test range for anything needing to be far enough from Abersford to avoid blowing up or immolating unsuspecting citizens and buildings, a precaution justified by more mishaps than Yosef was comfortable with.
Yosef! Exclaimed Yonful, running up to the carriage.
It stopped 30 yards behind 2 cannon carriages and a 2-foot by 2-foot block of wood 6 feet long. The cannons Yosef recognized as 6-pounders, but as gratified as he felt by their existence, it was the block that caught his attention. It sat on the ground lengthwise downrange and fastened by metal bands to the block was a large diameter cannon barrel. Yonful saw where Yosef's attention landed.
Yes, yes, a 12-pounder, Yosef.
It just finished cooling yesterday and we rushed to get it on a test block. We wanted to surprise you.
So you haven't test fired yet?
No, said Yonful. I thought you might want to see the first test firings.
Yeah, said Carnegie. And be the first to get blown up if the barrel splits like all the others we saw tested.
Yonfall's offended expression was comical, or would have been, if Carnegie's comment hadn't had a kernel of truth to it.
I'm sure we'll be safe enough behind the barriers,
said Yosef, placating the young foreman and indicating the 6-foot earthen berm 50 yards from the cannon's positions.
Go ahead, Yonfall, give us the show. I'll let Raziel fire them off, said Yawnful. None of this would be possible without him.
Works for me, muttered Balwis. If anything goes wrong, it's one less Narthani. Yosef shushed him.
Remember, he's our Narthani for now. Think of how many of them you might get a chance to kill if these cannon work.
Given a positive image to dwell on, Balwis appeared almost cheerful. For him. Carnegie took the carriage another 100 yards away and tied the horses to a tree. The other three travelers, Yawnfall and the rest of the foundry workers, moved behind the berm, leaving the grizzled Narthani artilleryman to do the honors. Whatever his ultimate loyalties, Yosef had to grant that Raziel appeared confident. Or perhaps indifferent. He stood next to the rightmost six-pounder, holding a 2-foot-long, 1/4-inch-thick rod of wood from an Anyar tree known for slow burning. Yosef could see the end glowing red and giving off tendrils of smoke. The firing rod was the device used to fire the swivel barrels. The rod, once an end was lit, would smolder for hours without extinguishing under any but the hardest rain. Once the other men were safe, with only their heads from nose up peering over the berm, Raziel touched the vent on the 6-pounders with the glowing end of the firing rod. With a roar, smoke gushed from the open end of the barrel, and the carriage recoiled several inches, despite an anchoring spike through a hole in the carriage trail and driven into the ground. From his position behind and to the left of the cannon, Yosef caught a glimpse of something flying downrange, then impacting the rock face, sending fragments exploding outward. He looked back at the 6-pounder. The barrel appeared unaffected. Raziel waited a few moments, then fired the second 6-pounder with the same result. With only a glance at the observers, he moved to the 12-pounder barrel fastened to the wooden block and touched the vent. The roar was louder, the cloud of smoke larger, and this time Yosef felt certain his eyes picked up the cannonball before it struck the rock face. The foundry workers cheered, rushed out to Raziel, and mobbed him. Raziel's grin was the first emotion Yosef had seen from the man.
They seem to get along with the Narthani, said Dennis. If he's willing to help us make working cannon, then I doubt we have to worry about him as a potential spy or anything.
Yosef ignored Dennis's comment, along with others offered by Balwis and Carnegie. His mind ran through implications as he strode quickly to the knot of men. Yawnfall, you say you test-fired the first 6-pounder barrel 10 times?
More. The first one Raziel lit off has now been fired 26 times. This is only the 4th firing for the second 6-pounder.
Yosef rubbed his palms together.
Let's have the men fire the second 6-pounder 6 more times and the 12-pounder 9 times. I want to see them all for myself before we make more plans.
The foundry workers dove into the request with a vengeance. Yosef had to stop them several times during the next firings to remind them to get back to the berm. By the 4th time, he gave up and let them stay with the cannon and reload as fast as they could. For the last 2 firings, Dennis and Balwis joined in and took turns swabbing out barrels between shots and ramming home charges and shot. On the last firing, Yosef looked at Carnegie.
You want to have a try?
Rolling his eyes, Carnegie said, Why the fuck would I want to do that?
15 minutes later, Yosef, Dennis, and Yawnfall met back at the foundry.
Very impressive, Yawnfall, said Yosef. You and the men can be proud of what you've accomplished.
The foreman beamed.
Now that means there's more work for you all. Your message said you were casting 5 more 6-pounder barrels. Is that right, or did you do more than that?
Yawnfall shook his head.
Only those 6 so far, Yosef. We didn't want to do more without your approval.
No problem, Yawnfall, said Yosef, not wanting the man to think he'd made a mistake. Now we need to ramp up production. I definitely need you and Raziel in Kernford as soon as possible. When's the fastest you can be ready to move?
Fastest. It'll take a couple more days to finish packing what we're taking with us. I've been turning over operating the foundry to Gilcor the last 6 days, and we've trained replacements for the 3 men coming with us. I think we can all be ready and wagons loaded, ready to leave 3 mornings from now.
Good, good.
I'll expect you in Kernford by the coming God's Day. I think the Kernford foundry can be up and operating in another 6 days after that. I want it to be as fast as possible. How many of the 6-pounder barrels have been mated to carriages?
All 6, said Yawnful,
although we haven't test-fired 4 of them.
Okay, get the men to do that testing. All 6-pounders that pass 10 test firings are to be sent to Kernford immediately.
Same with the 1 12-pounder. Get it on a carriage and send it with the 6-pounders, along with a supply shot. We'll need to start training as soon as possible. We'll let the foundry here focus only on 6-pounders. The Kernford foundry will cast all future 12-pounders and more 6-pounders.
Yosef turned to Dennis and asked,
What do you think?
I think we're going to kill a lot of Narthani. I also think I'm going to prefer the 12-pounders, especially where we might have to fight dismounted, like we did at Moreland City.
It's the 6-pounders for me, said Balwas. They should be able to keep up with horsemen better than the heavier cannon. We need to see exactly how fast they can travel.
Dennis nodded.
I agree, Balwas. When we get back to Kernford, I'll ask you to take a couple of the 6-pounders and a dragoon platoon and see how fast they can move together. Set up the guns, then move out again. I'll take the other 6-pounders and the 1 12-pounder and work on training more crews.
Yosef let the 2 men discuss the details, both obviously enthused by their new toys. While they planned, he took Yawnful aside.
I spoke with you before about mortars. Once we have the Kernford foundry working, I want to revisit casting a few mortars. I don't know yet how we'd use them, but I want to get started, at least with some experimenting.
He knew mortars had been used as early as the 15th century on Earth, almost entirely in siege situations. More mobile mortars hadn't been developed until the 17th and 18th centuries, and only in World War I did they have widespread use. It had been one of many instances where the knowledge of a weapon had to wait for technical developments to be practical for large-scale use. Mortars would be most useful only when they had contact fuses that worked with fired shells. Otherwise, the only use Yosef could see for mortars would be as siege weapons, throwing either stone or iron balls, or charges lit by hand, or by the gunpowder flash sweeping around the projectile to light a fuse. Such bulky mortars would be useless in open field battles and would be a bitch to move quickly. When he finished with the onfall, Yosef stood among the 6-pounders.
I know I should be pleased, he thought. The men have done a great job, and we're on our way to fixing the cannon shortage problem, but Christ, with 1 tank or even a real machine gun, I could end the Narthani threat.
A moment's reflection dashed those wishes because even if he had either weapon, the tank would need fuel, ammunition, and maintenance. And the machine gun would eat through ammunition that would have to be made by hand, shell by shell. He also reviewed in his mind the latest weapons development. Although the cannon were critical for offensive operations, napalm would be restricted to defense, as would the mortars, once they figured out the fusing problem. Mobile mortars with exploding shells were likely a year or more away, assuming they had the time and the resources. He constantly reminded himself not to get too ambitious, and that it was better to have many inferior weapons than one not yet fully deployable. He wished they had time to develop rifled muskets, but the few that existed on the island were imported, and even the Narthani soldiers didn't have them. Smoothbore muskets were just so much more efficient to produce, and the longer time it took to load a rifled musket argued further against them. Mini-A balls were the answer to the latter issue, but they hadn't been developed for another 100 years or more on Earth from where Anyar existed at this moment. The Kadeli would have to develop the crafts to make them, even if rifled muskets were an option. He remembered a famous short story by Arthur Clarke, one of the great science fiction writers. Superiority was set in the far future, when two divisions of humanity fight a war. One side has slightly superior weapons and more of them, but its leaders are constantly looking for better weapons instead of using what they have on the way to an inevitable victory. The other side stays with the weapons it has and slowly turns the war in its favor. The story, not one of Clark's better ones, had been required reading in one university engineering major, the lesson being to use the technology you had if it was good enough to do the job now. Then there were the United States' jets and tanks in World War II on Earth. America had developed jets and better tanks in time to produce them for the war, but had eschewed their production in favor of existing inferior planes and tanks. The reasoning was to swamp the enemy with what they had, instead of diverting resources. Yosef reminded himself of these lessons every time he felt tempted by ideas for new weapons.